Lecture 11, The Positivist Conception of Historical Knowledge, Karl Hempel's The Function of General Laws in History.
Karl Hempel was a member of a philosophical movement or school of thought that was very prevalent in the Anglo-American world in the first half of the 20th century, known as either logical positivism or logical empiricism. Some of its more famous members were figures associated with the so-called Vienna Circle, Moore Schlick, Otto Neurath, the young Ludwig Wittgenstein, A.J. Ayers, and of course Rudolf Carnap. What characterized logical positivism was, or logical empiricism was, on the one hand, the traditional positivist belief that science was the principal form of positive knowledge, and that all forms of disciplines which had a claim to knowledge, which were not scientific, were in fact illusory at best. That the only sort of knowledge you could really depend on was scientific knowledge. So as such, science then was the model for all empirical knowledge. What makes it logical was that the logical positivists were strongly moved by fundamental breakthroughs in logical research in the late 19th and early 20th century. And in fact, one of the reasons they saw science as the model of all empirical knowledge was that they recognized that logic was probably the model for all mathematical knowledge, and that such knowledge was not in fact empirical, but was analytic. Well, now, of course, that's a very broad, blustery sort of philosophical claim that science is the sum and substance of all of our knowledge of the world. Obviously, there are two domains which challenge that. First is the domain of common sense. How do we account for everyday knowledge, which doesn't seem to be scientific? And the logical positivists responded by treating that as a kind of primitive science. Or rather saying that science is, in a way, common sense made a bit more reflective. But that they argue that fundamentally, when our everyday knowledge, our common sense knowledge is adequate, it's because it, in a very rough way, mirrors the scientific method and scientific analysis. And they're both culled from experience through the use of trial and error, which, when refined, becomes the experimental method. The other challenge, of course, to the claim that science is the sum and substance of all knowledge is history, which does not seem to be an advanced science. It doesn't seem to produce general laws. Well, there's two strategies of dealing with that challenge. One is to continue to affirm your principle, acknowledge that history doesn't produce general laws, and simply say that it's not knowledge. It's anecdotal, it's a second-class sort of knowledge. It's sort of like gossip columnists. The other approach is to say that history does, in fact, give us knowledge. We don't want to violate that intuition that we have that somehow what historians say is capable of being either true or false, and claim that, in fact, it is a sort of primitive science, perhaps a little more advanced than common sense, but not yet up to the level of the advanced natural sciences like physics or chemistry. What underlay the entire positivist project was a commitment to what Hempel calls the methodological unity of the empirical sciences. That all of the sciences fundamentally applied the same method. There was one and only one scientific form of explanation. And all other forms of explanation, as we'll see, he terms pseudo-explanations. Things claiming to be explanatory, but in fact fail to offer valid inferences and valid explanations or deductions. Now, in the essay that we're going to examine, which was called The Function of General Laws in History, it was written in 1942 and published in the Journal of Philosophy, Hempel attempts to take on that challenge of history and explain why history is, in fact, a science and therefore validates the claim to the methodological unity of science. And his strategy, as I've mentioned, is he can't deny that history is knowledge. He doesn't want to deny that it's a science, so he wants to argue that it does, in fact, contribute to human knowledge. It may not produce; it may not be as rigorous as physics. It probably is what we would call a soft science, a science nonetheless. it has a valid explanatory scheme. It's simply not as rigorous as that of the other more advanced sciences. Okay. He begins with one fundamental premise and argument, that there is one and only one form of explanation that we know. All valid explanations require the use of general laws. Okay. What is a general law? A general law is a universal conditional proposition. It says something to the effect that if X, then Y, or all X's produce Y's. Right? Something absolutely without exception, and that always takes the form of a condition. If we get this first condition, we will get that afterwards. What general laws do is connect cause and event through that conditional nexus. Given some set of some conjuncture of conditions which stand as cause, we can expect with regularity to produce the effect as the result. Now, the function of such general laws is to supply predictions in science and explanations. What is required to be able to make such an explanation or prediction is the deduction of the event to be explained from a series of laws and initial conditions. And these initial conditions for the historian will always be preceding and causal conditions. I want to briefly read to you the conditions that Hempel lays down. Now, the assertion that a set of events, say of the kinds C1, C2, ellipsis through CN, have caused the event to be explained amounts to the statement that, according to certain general laws, a set of events of the kinds mentioned is regularly accompanied by an event of a kind E. Thus, the scientific explanation of the events in question consists of 1. A set of statements asserting the occurrence of certain events C1 through CN at certain times and places. A set of universal hypotheses such that A. The statements of both groups are reasonably well confirmed by empirical evidence. And B. From the two groups of statements, the sentence asserting the occurrence of event E can be logically deduced. Okay. So let us say we want to explain the occurrence of a revolution. We detail what we consider the initial conditions that are relevant. A shortage of bread, a breakdown of political legitimacy, followed by a defection among certain political elites, and a crisis within the military. Those will be the initial conditions. We then, having given those, apply some general law we might have, such that when the economy reaches a certain point of crisis, when legitimacy has been denied the regime at present, and when a certain degree of desperation and aspiration is held by certain elements in the society that have the possibility of political action, revolutions occur. We see if those initial conditions can be applied to that law to produce the prediction that a revolution occurs. We apply the correct dates, and in that way, explain perhaps the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution. Okay. So that's Hempel's interpretation or model of how explanations, in fact, work. That model could be used just as easily, in fact, far more easily, in characterizing explanations in physics or in other scientific disciplines. It always takes that form. You're given a set of initial conditions. The gas is at temperature X, at moment X. The pressure is increased on it. We should expect to see this happen to its temperature. It should rise. And you deduce that it should rise given the laws we have about how those things relate to each other. And then if, in fact, it does rise, you've explained the event effectively. Now, all physical explanations, those that are not historical, also do have one additional feature, which is worth mentioning now briefly, and that is boundary conditions. This theory will hold in these states. So I'm trying to think of an example off the top of my head. Well, in optics, we believe in the principle of the rectilinear propagation of light. Right? Light moves in straight lines. But we put boundary conditions on that. It doesn't move in a straight line through certain mediums. It doesn't move in a straight line through water. It doesn't move in a straight line through convex or concave lenses. Right? Then the light is diffracted. So those would be the boundary conditions within which the theory holds. And in fact, one could argue that the same thing would hold for history. One could come up with a theory of revolutions that explains the French Revolution, that explains the Russian Revolution. And in fact, there is an historian, Crane Brinton, who's done just that. He's come up with a general law of what causes all revolutions. And yet, when you come across cases where you would think that there should be a revolution given the initial conditions, he might be able to limit certain boundary conditions as to why they didn't occur. Why wasn't there a revolution among slaves in the 19th century South? Well, it turns out you have to make up at least a certain percentage of the population to be able to even think of being successful. They're always a minority of the population. Therefore, although the conditions are ripe for revolution, otherwise they don't fall within the boundary condition. There won't be a revolution. Or some other community may not have the proper information necessary to be able to organize in a revolutionary fashion. This is just one example. Okay, something else we should note about such explanations. They generally examine not an event in its entirety, but a particular property of an event. In other words, going back to the cases of studying gases, the explanation will attempt to explain the rise in temperature of a gas by increasing its pressure. It doesn't try to explain, say, what the gas smelled like, or what color it is. There may be different explanations for that, but an explanation is always relative to a particular property, to a particular feature. And that means that the event must always be characterized under a specific description. And this is an important point, because every event, and this is one of the wonderful things that logical positivists and analysts after, analytic philosophers after them realize, is that events can be described from an infinite number of angles and an infinite number of perspectives. A fine example I've used before in class, one could describe in physiological terms the following situation. Two men are sitting about five feet apart with a table between them and pieces of plastic on the table. One picks up a piece of plastic and moves it 3 inches forward. Another picks up another piece of plastic and moves it 3 inches toward the other. We could also describe that as two people playing chess. One plays pawn to king four, the other plays pawn to king four. We could also describe that same event in psychological terms. One person is trying to psych the other out by playing an opening that is completely unsound, and that the other knows is unsound and is just playing head games with him. So there's a wide variety of ways that we could describe any event. All of our explanations will always be relative to a particular description. This is important because what it means is that there's no such thing as a complete description of an event. All descriptions are relative to some particular set of properties with which we want to engage our explanatory energies. And thus there is no such thing as a total explanation. So when the historian turns and tells us, well, science may work just fine for understanding the way billiard balls move, but humans are more complex. There's too much to the situation, in the human situation, than in, say, the movement of billiard balls on a pool table, we respond by saying that that criticism works just as well for billiard balls as it does for humans. There is an infinite number of ways of describing what's going on with those billiard balls when one strikes another and moves it. Our explanations are always relative to a particular description. We happen to generally be interested in the forces and the momentum that one billiard ball transfers to another. But there's a lot of different ways to describe it. And similarly with history. We can have scientific explanations in history, but they must be relative to particular characteristics of an event, never relative to an event as a whole. On this, Hempel's quite insistent. There is no difference in this respect between history and the natural sciences. Both can give an account of their subject matter only in terms of general concepts, and history can, quote, grasp the unique individuality of its objects of study no more and no less than can physics or chemistry. In every case, we are looking at a particular features or properties with which we want to engage in an explanatory way. And that means that the claim that history must, because each historical event is fundamentally unique, be ideographic or concerned with the individual, is a fundamental confusion of the nature of the way the other sciences work. Every physical event is also absolutely unique. No two experiments are identical. At least their spatiotemporal coordinates have changed. Right? There's no reason to claim a greater sort of individuality for human behaviors than for the behaviors of various subatomic particles on the one hand, or other mammals and species on the other. Okay, so that seems to Hempel, and obviously to most positivists, as a sort of superstition, as a sort of metaphysical hobby horse of meta-historians. Okay, this brings us to the discussion of explanations and their contrast with what positivists like to call pseudo-explanations. Pseudo is a very popular word among the positivists. It's very much of a young man's philosophy, full of bluff and bluster. And when it comes across people who disagree with it and argue for other principles, they're told that those are pseudo-concepts, pseudo-explanations, pseudo-theories, and pseudo-arguments. Okay. Valid explanations, according to Hempel, occur only when there are general laws. And these general laws connect cause and effect in a deductive structure. And obviously this is the structure which today is called the deductive hypothetical method, or the nomological method. And the point here is that's the only form of explanation we know, or at least the only valid form. It's the use of such laws that distinguishes a real explanation, one that truly satisfies, from a pseudo-explanation. Now, what form do pseudo-explanations take? They may invoke principles like, say, entelechy or teleology to explain the growth of organic entities and things like fate and destiny in history. So an example, a pseudo-explanation for Hempel would be Aristotle's old belief that acorns become oak trees because that's their entelechy, that's the natural form to which they develop. To him, that's a pseudo-explanation. The right explanation is they develop towards oak trees because they have some sort of genetic coding in them, which, when given the proper nutrition, plays out its program and grows. Similarly, in history, the notion that Caesar crossed the Rubicon because it was his fate, or because history led him in that direction, is, for Hempel, a pseudo-explanation, right? That's directly similar to saying that the acorn becomes the oak tree because that's its entelechy. That's what towards which it naturally moves and naturally ends. So if there is not a general law, what you're getting in such an explanation is purely metaphorical, or an appeal to your emotions through vague analogies. The North won the Civil War because it was the United States was reaching its maturity and growing in its stature. The United States isn't a person. It doesn't mature. It never was fed with milk and didn't move through baby food and didn't eventually learn to walk. It's a nation, a system of institutions. To apply such an analogy appeals to our emotions as Americans. We feel certain pride of the infant nation and the growing nation. But it certainly exists no explanatory edge, no handle on it. It can't be verified. It can't be falsified. It's something which we accept only because it appeals to perhaps our prejudices or our desires. So anytime we hear the word fate or destiny or mission in history, we know we're being appealed to our emotions by historical advertising men, and we're being subjected to pseudo-explanation. A truly scientific explanation is always capable of some form of objective test. It never requires an empathetic understanding, a getting inside of the head and feeling some sort of fellow feeling with that of the analyst, historian, or subject. It always can be tested in some straightforward empirical way. Now, how so? There are three things that every scientific explanation is capable of being tested by. First, those initial conditions, the initial state of affairs from which change will occur. always should be subject or capable of empirical verification. So, to say that, again, the price of bread was skyrocketing before the revolution and there was desperation on the part of the people, that must be something which you can empirically verify, either through studying and finding evidence of the price of bread or reading in the common people's journals about their desperation and growing desperation in newspaper accounts. Examples of initial conditions that won't satisfy that. The American spirit was preparing to emerge from its religious phase into the height of the Enlightenment come the revolution. How the heck would you ever test that? I mean, does the American spirit leave some sort of diary somewhere? Is it? If it did, I'm sure it's hidden in Boston. I've always sensed that the American spirit in the colonial period lived in Boston. Okay, so that's one thing. You must be able to somehow empirically check those initial conditions. There must be some sort of empirical test of the universal hypothesis. If you're going to claim that whenever a larger military force faces a smaller military force, it wins, you must be able to test that in examples. And the fact that if you can come across a counterexample, you can falsify that hypothesis may show that it was a wrong hypothesis, but at least it was a valid hypothesis. Invalid hypotheses are ones that you can never even imagine how to test. The stronger army always wins. How do we know it's stronger? Because it won. What sort of a universal law is that? I mean, that's an absolutely useless and unverifiable law. Finally, you must be able to check that the inferences drawn are all valid and coherent. So when told that your explanatory principle contains some contradiction, right? I mean, the United States, or off the top of my head, we fought the Civil War for the sake of freedom, and yet we wound up imposing a system of debt peonage on blacks in the South within 20 years. That would seem to be a contradiction, right? I mean, that wouldn't hold up as an explanation. When we're told then by some analyst, ah, yes, but that's the contradiction of the dialectic, the inherent tension of the dialectic. It always works through contradictions. We know that that is, again, a pseudo-explanation. That's a completely incoherent explanation. Whenever I make sense with an explanation like that, then, of course, it's logically valid. And when it doesn't, I just say, oh, it's the dialectical tension. Things are so complex. That's the subtlety and the rich texture of historical reality. Whenever you hear people talk about the rich texture of things and the complicated nature of things, according to Hempel, you know someone's trying to pull a fast one on you, explanatory-wise. The world may be complex. Explanations must be simple. And inferences must be valid. We cannot say when we come across a contradiction in our explanation, well, we're just mirroring the complexity of the world. That won't do. Inferences are either valid or they're not valid. Okay. So those three checks, the check on the empirical initial conditions, empirical check on the universal hypotheses, and a check that the inferences and principles of argument are in fact valid, should obtain in any truly valid explanatory scheme. Now, one of the arguments made against this model of historical explanation, against this epistemological view of history. And by epistemology, we mean the science of knowledge, or the study of knowledge. Right? How we know what we know, and whether, in fact, we do know what we claim to know. One of the arguments against this sort of an epistemology of history as science is that science is predictive. Right? Given initial conditions, we predict future states, and we verify that by running experiments and seeing if our predictions are, in fact, the case. But obviously with history, as Collingwood pointed out, I think quite trenchantly, there are no experiments. And Vico pointed this out as well. There is no prediction in history. We don't prophesize about the future. We're only talking about the past. And that's, of course, a problem that Hempel has to engage. His solution to that problem is to argue that the distinction between prediction and explanation is not a function of logical form. In other words, the logical form of an explanation of a past event is, in fact, identical to the logical form of a prediction of a future event. The difference is only in the temporal position of the analyst. When we explain events, they are events which have occurred in the past. When we predict them, they have yet to occur. So predictions are simply explanations of events that have not yet occurred. He then points out that many of, in fact, the explanations in the physical sciences, which are considered scientific, are not predictions, right? They're explanations of past events. When the theory of nuclear winter was first being computer modeled, and people used that then to try to explain the disappearance of the dinosaurs, right? That a large celestial body struck the Earth and produced a huge dust cloud, which destroyed enough vegetation so that the dinosaurs couldn't survive. The only thing they could survive were a little rodent-like animal that eventually evolved into humanity. That is a scientific explanation. It's not of an event that is yet to occur. It's an event that, if it did occur, occurred 13 million years ago. Okay. Similarly, think of astronomy. Most of what astrophysicists attempt to explain has already occurred, right? They rarely are engaging in predictions about the future. Even when they do engage in predictions about the future, about when we should expect to observe some particular star supernova, let's say, they are, in fact, not predictions about future events. They're predictions about what we will see in the future. But those stars, if they're right, supernovaed long ago, right? So much of science, in fact, most of its predictions actually refer to the past, not to the future. Or a good deal of them do. And yet we don't dare say, in the case of the astronomer, describing what happened in some, or what we'll see has happened in some galaxy far ago, does not say, well, astronomy is not a science, because it doesn't predict things in the future. Well, if you don't make that argument against astronomy, if astronomy cuts it as a science, why not history? And it strikes me that Hempel here has a very strong argument. The claim that history can't offer any sort of nomothetic or scientific explanation because its events are all in the past is entirely an irrelevancy and is a function of the scientific illiteracy of historians who assume that scientists are doing one thing when, in fact, they don't. Okay. Now, I want to turn to the question of what Hempel calls incomplete explanations. And this will turn out to actually categorize why history is a science, but a soft science. Many common sense explanations that we have in everyday life are incomplete. They're incomplete in this way. What they usually offer us are the initial conditions, the event, and a tacit assumption that there is some sort of law which connects those things. The tacit assumption of that law shows up in summed up words which sum up where we would put the law if we knew it. We use words like because or therefore. So, you know, your barn burns down, you ask your son Johnny, Johnny, why did the barn burn down? He says, the barn burned because a match was dropped in the hay. Right? The because stands for some general law, which he doesn't know. He doesn't know the laws of chemistry. If he did, he'd put it in. It would say the lit match or the dropped match is clearly the initial condition. He would come up with some laws which describe the way a lit match engages some sort of combustion with other sort of material once it's dried out, which will then spread and temperatures will increase and destroy whatever structures are being consumed if they're made of wood or certain other structural features. And undoubtedly, we could come up with the scientific laws for that. Johnny doesn't know it, but he has good reason to assume there are such laws. So he just says, because. He gives you the initial conditions, gives you the events, and the word because sort of sums up where the law should fit. And since that's adequate for everyday experience, we accept that. That's not to say it's not a scientific explanation. It is, but it's incomplete. It's missing something. But nonetheless, it passes muster for our practical needs. An example in history. The Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. Therefore, the United States declared war on them. Right? Therefore, sums up some sort of law, such that if we re-describe the Japanese dropping or bombing Pearl Harbor as an act of aggression against a powerful nation, we could probably think of what would be the appropriate law. Whenever a powerful nation is attacked by an aggressor in its own territories and its military facilities, it's placed in a situation which it must respond. One of the natural responses is a declaration of war under certain circumstances. Therefore, That the Japanese did fulfill those initial conditions, the Americans fulfill the initial conditions, we get the result, the declaration of war. The fact is, rarely will you find such laws laid out in a history book. What you have is an incomplete explanation, but it's not a pseudo-explanation, because we have good reason to believe that such laws exist. Right? So the use of the therefore in that case does not preclude the possibility that this was, in fact, some sort of scientific explanation. Now, there are cases in which the incompleteness, the failure to produce the law, is, in fact, essential. And that is because we can't supply the appropriate laws and descriptions. The major reason that would be the case is because in some cases we can't in fact formulate a law, only a probabilistic hypothesis. There doesn't seem to be a clear law about, say, the spread of disease. Rather, it seems to follow probability functions. Or, say, the onset of recessions. There's not a mathematical certainty about it. There are simply probabilities. But even these are valid explanatory laws. Right? So those are the two forms of valid, though incomplete, descriptions. Inessentially complete ones, ones where we don't bother to put in the laws because we really don't care about the laws, but we assume they're there, otherwise we wouldn't have an explanation. Or those in which we can't put in the laws because the laws wouldn't actually be law-like, they'd be probabilistic. But in fact, if the scholar was interested in doing so, and some are, they do in fact come up with those probability functions. All right, so what would we now call the sort of explanation historians offer when they give you initial conditions, the causal conditions, they give you the event to be explained, and they roughly indicate what more or less those laws should be? Hempel calls that an explanation sketch. It's not exactly an explanation, but it's close enough and it'll pass muster. The bulk of historians who don't offer laws don't offer full explanations, but they do offer these explanation sketches, which are adequate to the task. That's not to say that no historians ever include full explanations or even statements of laws. In fact, he quotes from Donald W. McConnell's Economic Behavior, as the activities of the government are enlarged, more people develop a vested interest in the continuation and expansion of government functions. And you will find this in some history texts, the statement of the laws, and I read to you. People who have jobs do not like to lose them. It's not only common sense, it's a law. Those who are habituated to certain skills do not welcome change. Common sense, law. Those who have become accustomed to the exercise of a certain kind of power do not like to relinquish their control. If anything, they want to develop greater power and correspondingly greater prestige. Thus, government offices and bureaus, once created, in turn institute drives not only to fortify themselves against assault, but to enlarge the scope of their operations. This is a complete explanation. We've started out with certain hypothetical initial conditions, produced laws, from it deduced the state of affairs that he wanted deduced. And the point is not because it's necessarily the correct explanation. The point is to say that, first of all, it's not the case that no historians offer laws. Some do. I would argue to some extent Marxism offers law. To some extent Weber's sociological analysis offers some sorts of laws. Even a Toynbee's model of history offers some sort of laws. Nonetheless, it is a fair case to be made that the vast bulk of historians do not, in fact, offer the laws. They only offer the sketches, which... And the reason he calls them sketches is they vaguely gesture at what the laws might be, and they can be sketched in at a later point by future research, if some scholar should so desire. Although the laws are not necessarily present, a sketch is capable of empirical test. And for that reason, an explanation sketch is not a pseudo-explanation. But at the same time, it is fair to say that it's not... equally testable with a full-blown explanation. So again, it passes muster in the same way common sense explanations pass muster about the barn burning because a match was dropped in it. We can test it. Was the hay wet? If the hay was wet, it's not likely that the match actually caused it. It may have been the result of arson. But again, it's not as testable as it would have been given all the physical laws we need. Okay, so despite the lack of stated laws within history texts, History is, in fact, nomothetic, or law-like in its explanatory structure. It's like any other sort of explanation, in that it tries to show that the occurrence that's being explained was not chance. It wasn't random. If it was random, then it would make very little sense to try to describe it or analyze it in any way. In fact, all histories presuppose that the events to be explained were the result of certain prior or present conditions. The Civil War must have had something to do with the election of Abraham Lincoln, the Kansas-Nebraska Act, and the breakdown of political order in the 1850s and the breakdown of the party structure. If not, why do those things show up in books about the causes of the Civil War? Why not start your book on the Civil War, if those things aren't the causes, with a discussion of Renaissance painting, followed by, the Brooklyn Dodgers moving to Los Angeles, right? If events are not caused by previous conditions, why not put anything in the book? Or better yet, why not just say the Civil War started at this date and ended at this date, and that's all I have to say? Obviously, historians assume that these events are not random, that something causes them. Certain prior events or present conditions. Nonetheless, it is the case that most historians don't think they're engaging in nomothetic law-like explanation. And in fact, it is the case that most historians do leave out the laws that they presume or presuppose. Now, there are a couple reasons they do this. First of all, in fact, most historians, the laws they draw on are very much like the laws we used in burning down the barn. They're common sense laws. They're laws from human psychology or everyday sociology. They're a very common, shared, trite set of knowledge. You know, when people are hungry, they get desperate. When people are pushed, they fight back. These aren't particularly sophisticated theses, and, you know, historians have PhDs and want to be sophisticated like everyone else, and we're embarrassed to state laws like that. I mean, it makes us seem very lowbrow. So because these laws are so common and trite, historians don't feel they're worth stating. And so they don't state them. And it's because they don't state them, they don't think that history is, in fact, law-like. Sometimes, however, it's not because they're trite, but because they're incredibly complex. Think of the range of initial conditions that are necessary to produce a revolution, as opposed to just a riot. There's so many contingencies involved that distinguish a rebellion and a riot and a brief insurrectionary flare-up from a revolution that it might take years and years of research to specify those laws. And the historian may not really be interested in that. He may be interested in much more in the particular revolution to be explained. So he says, well, some other scholar can figure out what the laws are. I'll just gesture roughly at what they might be. And get at particulars. Now, consider an example. Could we state, without incredible research, the laws which led to which led Dust Bowl farmers from Oklahoma to migrate to California? Right. Take quite a bit of thought, quite a bit of research, probably more than merits. More than the event itself merits. Yet at the same time, we must believe somehow that there was some causal mechanism, or was it just a coincidence that all these people from Oklahoma moved to California at roughly the same time, and it just seemed to happen after the Dust Bowl? So we do tend to assume that there must be some sort of law-like connection between the devastation of a particular agricultural region and the movement of those agricultural workers to a more hospitable climate. But we might not be able to formulate the law because it's just too complex for the historian. As a result, he leaves the law out and assumes that the law is insignificant. But as the historian tacitly assumes, without ever stating it and admitting it to himself, he does assume there is such a law because he assumes there's a causal relation there. So there must be some mechanism connecting the Dust Bowl to the emigration of the, quote, Okies to California. Part of the reason historians don't think they're engaging in a nomothetic discipline is because they are wary of what we might call, or what Hempel calls, specifically historical laws. Which is to say, historians think that if history is to be nomothetic, to be a science, there must be unique laws of history which are distinct from the laws of any other discipline. And they simply don't have any. I mean, perhaps one might argue Marxism supplies some of these, perhaps Weber, perhaps Toynbee. But consider, Marx's laws would be subsumed under the discipline of philosophy or economics. Weber's under that of sociology, not necessarily history. And Toynbee, perhaps, might be considered a bit too trivial or social-psychological. Well, in fact, most of the laws used by any and every historian come from other disciplines. Biology, economics, physics, chemistry. When we describe why one assaulting army was able to breach the walls of another, the laws we're presupposing in describing that military action are, in fact, the laws of probably chemistry and physics. Laws of forces, of cannonballs, and laws of combustion and the changing in physical states, the use of various sort of explosive devices and incendiary devices. Similarly, when we describe the panic of a particular economic period, say of the era of good feelings, a financial crisis at that time, we're assuming the existence of laws from economics. That doesn't mean, because these laws are not formulated by historians themselves, that historical explanations aren't law-like. One might think of historians as people drawing together laws from all of the disciplines and using them to explain the human past. In fact, the use of any evidence at all by the historian presupposes general laws. How so? I take a look at the journal of Thomas Shepard, a minister in 17th century Massachusetts. There must be general laws connecting them, because it's a book published in the 20th century. So I must believe that somehow this book is a copy of the original text. And that would presuppose a general law, that when publishers claim to be reproducing an original copy, they are in fact doing so because there are legal mechanisms which will punish them if they don't. I must also assume that when a text is signed by an author, which is to say the original, that it is in fact a result of his own writing, and that it is in fact a result of his own beliefs. So to use any evidence at all requires a belief in general laws. To say that if I look at the original copy of the Declaration of Independence with the signatures at the bottom, to claim that that is a source to tell us something about the way our nation was formed assumes general laws, that this same document has persisted over time, and that without reason to believe that it has been burned and replaced with a sham copy with changed words in it, I'm employing general laws, that without contrary evidence, I have good reason to believe it's the same copy. Okay. Now, I want briefly then to respond to, mention Hempel's response to a couple of the claims by Collingwood in particular. First, the claim to an empathetic understanding, getting inside the figure of the agent, understanding how it must have felt to that historical person in that position. Neo-idealists who do this are confusing a heuristic technique of their own understanding with an explanatory device. In fact, when the historian places himself in the situation of the agent, think about what he's really doing. He is trying to consider what the causal forces that were impinging on that individual were. And that is a nomothetic discipline, isn't it? Right? By saying, what must have been going through Caesar's mind, you ask yourself, what general causal forces were impinging on Caesar's situation? What general laws did he have to account for? Okay. And this requires no particular affinity for the person in question. In fact, it can be done with figures with whom we have the most absolute distaste. Absolutely objective scholars like William Shirer and Alan Bullock can understand the motivations of Adolf Hitler. They despise Hitler. They don't share his mentality in any sense. But they say, okay, given a man who had these sorts of proclivities and these sorts of events were occurring around him, what was likely to be his motivation in coming up with responses? Okay. Now, briefly, I want to mention two other sorts of historical understanding. One, theoretical these come in two varieties. There are some explanations which are nomothetic. Marxism is a nomothetic explanatory scheme. It may be wrong, but it's law-like. It can be disproved if it's wrong, and that's one of its virtues. It may be scientific and just wrong science. Similarly, social Darwinism, any sort of law-like posit, a Weberian sociology, that's one sort of theory of history. The other sort is something which assumes events under some general idea. The growth of the world's spirit over time, the rise of progress across history. It's the latter which are pseudo-explanations. It's the latter which can't be tested empirically. And it's the latter which fall outside of the domain of legitimate historical understanding and explanation. Thank you very much.